I'm Rachel, the creative director for Ram Dass's Love Serve Remember Foundation, and I'd like to welcome you to our Inner Academy, a virtual Dharma hall where our family of wisdom teachers will help you navigate your daily life by bringing ancient wisdom into a modern context. With over 200 hours of audio and video teachings, meditations, and practices from teachers like Ram Dass, Krishna Dass, Sharon Salzberg, Jack Kornfield, Roshi Joan Halifax, Joseph Goldstein, and many more, the Inner Academy is your core resource for finding balance, presence, and navigating the ups and downs of your daily life. The Inner Academy has guidance for every step of your journey. Choose from an annual or monthly membership and gain access to past and future courses, retreat replays, virtual community, and much more. If you've been familiar with Love Serve Remember Foundation for a while, you'll know that most of our offerings are given freely or on a sliding scale basis. So when you subscribe to the Inner Academy, you're paying it forward and bolstering our ability to continue creating accessible offerings for all in the future, as Ram Dass wished for us to do. Be here now and start your journey with Ram Dass's Inner Academy today. For more, visit ramdass.org/innerAcademy.
Teaching meditation can be a deeply rewarding experience. Help others improve their mental and emotional well-being, reduce stress, improve focus, increase self-awareness and self-regulation, all while deepening your own practice and understanding. Join acclaimed author, Buddhist teacher, and Emmy Award-winning musician David Nickturn on Tuesday, May 28th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time for a free online discussion on teaching meditation in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/be-here-now for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nickturn on May 28th.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
I mean, there's that sense that we do everything in such a rush now, and that we do five things at once always. Mm-hmm. That means that we just cannot pay attention to the world that is asking for our attention. You know, we don't spend time just existing within one paradigm at once.
Hello, and welcome to the Metta Hour podcast with Sharon Salzberg. I'm Lily Cushman. I'm the producer of this podcast. Today, we're coming to you with episode 225, which is a conversation between Sharon and Catherine May. Catherine is an author, an international best-selling author, to be more specific. She's a podcaster, and today's conversation is mostly centered around her new book, Enchantment, Awakening Awe in an Anxious Age. This is Catherine's newest book that came out earlier in 2023. It was an instant New York Times bestseller, a Sunday Times bestseller. But Catherine is probably more known for her previous book, Wintering, which was such a massive international bestseller. It's a hybrid memoir. She's also been a presenter for On Being in their Future of Hope series. So this is one of my new favorite episodes. And a lot of this conversation centers around how we can come into a more vivid contact with life, and learning to pay attention again in a different way, a new way. And of course, there is a lot looking at some of the Buddhist approach to that. Catherine is also just a beautiful writer, a beautiful speaker, and she's so deeply explored her own relationship to awe and how that has kind of expanded her whole way of relating to the world. That includes the natural world, but also not limiting awe to something that's just pretty, like a sunset, but the way we can just be real with ourselves and be messy, but also be really in direct contact with life as it's happening around us. So I think you're going to enjoy this conversation a lot. I know I did. Before we get to the episode, a few announcements for you. If you haven't heard, Sharon has a new book coming out October 10th, Finding Your Way. And this is her second brand new book this year, which is a lot of the fruits of her time in quarantine coming into the world. This is a book unlike any other that Sharon has put out. It is a full-color illustrated gift book. It's kind of like a little coffee table book. And it centers around some of Sharon's most popular quotes, as well as quotes from some other incredible figures. And these small essays that Sharon has written around each of the quotes. So it's really a book that I think is perfect for someone who maybe isn't familiar with Sharon's work, maybe not a meditator, but it's that kind of book you can open to any page and walk away with a little nugget to pick you up, to inspire you, to encourage you. And we've got a few things happening for this book release. The first is that you can pre-order the book today, and our publisher is offering a 20% discount on the book if you pre-order it. So if you go to our website, you can find that link and pre-order a copy. And if you pre-order, you can also receive this free poster. It's an illustration that's inspired by the book. So our publisher will mail you one of those if you fill out the little form with your pre-order. Also, Sharon's going to be doing a book launch event on October 10th. It's hosted by the Insight Meditation Society's Book Club. And if you go to our website, you can join us there. So let's get to today's conversation. Sharon Salzberg and Catherine May.
Hello, Catherine. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Sharon. Thank you so much for having me.
It's wonderful to be together with you again, and looking forward to sharing you and your work with our listeners out there. So tell me how you are and where you are. Where are you beaming in from?
Yeah, beaming in. I am at home in Whitstable in the very southeast of England. Mm. So I live about a 5-minute walk away from the sea. And it's a beautiful day, actually. It's sunny and I can hear the seagulls. I worry that you guys can hear the seagulls too, because quite often people notice them. but maybe that's like a little bit of texture. I don't know.
Well, I promise if I hear a seagull, I'll say, "What's that? What's that?"
Nice. I know, it's weird. I mean, I don't notice them that much because they're just this constant background to my life. But other people can hear them and get all excited and say, "It's like being by the seaside."
That's beautiful. So many congratulations on your new book, Enchantment, Awakening Wonder in an Anxious Age, which came out this past spring of 2023. I think that's a beautiful title.
Oh, thank you. It's we wrestled with the title a little because I felt very strongly that I wanted to talk about enchantment simply because we so often talk about disenchantment, you know, and that's a conversation that we fall so easily into, this sort of cynicism and sense that everything's terrible and there's nothing that can be done about it. And I really wanted the word enchantment to feel maybe even a little bit challenging to people, a little bit terrifyingly positive for once. Mm-hmm. But we did wrestle with it because we were scared it was going to frighten people off.
Mm. I know that feeling, actually. And I also noticed that, interestingly to me, the book's subtitle is slightly different between the U.S. and the U.K. editions. The U.K. edition is Reawakening Wonder in an Exhausted Age, and the U.S. edition is Awakening Wonder in an Anxious Age. So I'm wondering if that was intentional, if we're actually more anxious, which, I mean, most people I talk to here in the U.S. would describe themselves as anxious and exhausted.
Yes, I think I could have just put a list in that. I mean, honestly, my chosen subtitle for both of them was Awakening Wonder in a Burned Out Age. So I didn't get my wish. Mm-hmm. But it's interesting, isn't it, that the editors in different countries felt like a different subtitle resonated better. And yeah. I'm happy to defer to that. But isn't it interesting that in the UK we're more kind of comfortable with talking about being exhausted, mm-hmm. and Americans are more, you know, comfy with expressing anxiety, like that it tells such a lot about those different societies, whereas I'm just all about being burnt out all the time. Yeah. Obviously.
No, that's great. There's a word in the Pali, the language of the original Buddhist text, that is longing for a good translation, and it's considered the near enemy of compassion. It's like the state that can masquerade as compassion but isn't really. And it's close enough so that on a superficial level, it can look like compassion, but it's not. Recently, a translator scholar said to me, really, it's burnout. That's the state. You know, where one acknowledges the suffering, one is aware of it, but it's like too much, you know?
Yeah, and that sense that you, I mean, there's a term, isn't there, a compassion fatigue?
Yeah.
Which I think is so very real at the moment, that sense that you haven't got anything left in you to carry on caring.
That's right.
And yeah, that sounds like a really very useful word for right now.
So I'd like to start with a short passage from your book, which reads, I've lost some fundamental part of my knowing, some elemental human feeling. Without it, the world feels like tap water left overnight, flat and chemical, devoid of life. I'm like lightning seeking earth. Uneasy, I carry the prickle of potential energy in my limbs, ever deferred from the point of contact, the moment of release. Instead, it gathers in me, massing like a storm that never comes. I lack the language to even describe it, this vast, unsettled sense that I am slipping over the glassy surface of things, afraid of what lurks beneath. I need a better way to walk through this life. I want to be enchanted again. How beautiful and evocative of that.
It sounds
scene.
Great when you read it, honestly. I love listening to that. Thank you.
Well, I mean, it's everything. It's both the burnout, the almost despair, the caring, and wishing one could actually move from that caring. And I need a better way to walk through this life.
Yeah. And I think the word in that sort of draws me the most is contact. You know, this sense that we have lost a feeling of direct contact with so many different things, you know, and I think that expresses it in everything from the way that technology is now so mysterious to us, you know, that if my computer broke, I couldn't fix it. Whereas when I was growing up, I think pretty much most things that I came into contact with, I had a chance of fixing them if I knew how. And now that's been taken away from us, like our sort of physical expertise in the world is gone. But also this sense of contact with the divine, with how we feel even, and with our pleasure and with our joy. Everything's happening at one remove, and I really meditated a lot on this word contact when I began to write the book. It seemed really crucial to me.
Well, it's interesting because writing, like Zooming perhaps, can feel like being out of contact, but it's so intimate in its own way.
Yeah, I used to, in my previous job, I used to work with visual artists, and they the act of writing always seemed so bloodless to them. And it, you know, I remember talking to them a lot about this, and they always saw themselves as doing something really physical and having this like direct contact with the medium they worked in. And they couldn't understand why I didn't want that. Mm-hmm. Whereas to me, that's what I seek through writing as well. Like I'm often circling something. I'm getting closer and closer to exploring a feeling or a desire or a need. And I often don't get there very quickly. I have to keep working through layers and layers until I get that electric hit of contact. And that's exactly why I do it. I think I'm looking for that over and over again.
Yeah, one of the things that struck me very strongly in that passage was the sense of seeking. It's like there's something very alive in it, you know, as sort of flat and chemical, devoid of life, as it may seem. There's something in you as the writer and expressing it for the rest of us that is very vital and alive, that is almost an essential aspect of being human, that wants a better way to walk through this life.
I think I often experience being human as a state of restlessness. You know, that nothing is ever seems permanent or final to me. And I don't even want it to be, I don't think. But that seeking, that sense that you're looking for what's underneath everything, and you're looking to kind of unpeel layers of life to get to that core of it, it's definitely everything that drives me, I think. I find it hard to understand people that don't have that restlessness, you know. It seems really fundamental to me.
Well, that's very interesting too, and it makes me think of the ways we pay attention, and even the quality of awe, you know, which has a lot to do with how we pay attention and what we pay attention to, I think, because I wouldn't describe myself as a restless person at all. It's more my issues on the other side. Like, let's pick up the energy a little bit, you know? But I can see that the quality of attention is absolutely crucial, you know, because without paying attention more fully or more cleanly in a way, without so much assumption and ideas of what to expect, and without a kind of cleaner, clearer, better attention, I'm not going to connect to anything, you know, the cup of tea I'm drinking or the person in front of me that's speaking or the world around me.
No, absolutely. And I mean, there's that sense that we do everything in such a rush now, and that we do five things at once always. That means that we just cannot pay attention to the world that is asking for our attention. You know, we don't spend time just existing within one paradigm at once. And I've, you know, like I say that in full recognition that I definitely do it too. You know, I would quite often be watching TV and doing a crossword at the same time, for example. But I absolutely try and practice paying attention to one thing at a time as often as I can. And I, you know, draw myself back into to not existing within that constant noise. And I find, you know, like people often begin interviews with me by asking, what do we need to do to feel awe? How can we bring that about? And I don't think that's the question in lots of ways. I think the question is, how can I learn to pay attention again? Because the wonder, the awe, the fascination will flow from that. It's the world is fundamentally fascinating, but we have to make space to allow that fascination to arrive. And actually, that means doing one thing at a time. It means slowing down a bit. It means not overbooking our calendars. But the awe itself is right there, I think. It's just that we have to train our attention a little bit differently.
I would completely, wholeheartedly agree with that. And my favorite word, because I realize I tend to have a favorite word. For a long period, actually, it was poignant. And ooh, that, nice. That sense of compassion, which is a little bit heartbreaking a little bit sometimes, you know, not hopefully so much that you just need to go back to bed, because then it's compassion fatigue or empathy fatigue or burnout, you know. But nowadays, my favorite word actually is emergent. Because I feel like so many of the things I want or we want, we seek love, connection, awe, clarity, are emergent properties of the way we pay attention. And if we address that question of attention, many of the things we long for will emerge.
Yeah. Yeah. It's the key to so very much, isn't it? And I also like emergent in terms of thinking about the world at the moment, because it feels to me that there is so much that is emergent right now.
Yeah.
There's a cycle that's closed and a cycle that's opening up again. And I don't think any one of us know how to truly understand it at the moment. But being this sort of uncontrollable optimist, which I haven't always been, but apparently I am these days, I'm paying attention to those things. Like, I can't help but notice that there are some really incredible emergent values that are coming in and that are settling themselves upon us. And I'm gonna share your favorite word at the moment. I like it.
Great.
I hope you don't mind sharing.
No, it's wonderful. We'll have to keep checking in with one another and watch what emerges over time, because I see my own has shifted. So I've heard or read that this book is almost in sequence with Wintering, which was your last book, almost like a next natural step. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, that was the question I was asking myself when I was writing it, certainly, is you know, literally, well, what do I write next? And I mean, it was a hard thing to do, because I was aware by the time I sat down to write Enchantment that Wintering had meant so much to so many people. And I found that kind of mysterious, if I'm honest, that it had had that level of impact. I had not expected it. And I'm still working through the process of understanding that, honestly. And understanding the depth of feeling that there is around that book. I mean, I spent a long time denying that there was that depth of feeling, and I know I really, at least I've moved on from there. But it left me at a bit of a loss to think about what I could possibly say next that would help, you know, and that would speak into this moment. And I started writing it when we were just at the beginning of the pandemic, and I knew that by the time it was published, the world was completely unpredictable to me. You know, we know that it takes a long time for a book to come into the world, and so I was thinking, well, what can I possibly say that's gonna matter then? I suppose I really turned, it took me a long time, it took me a lot of drafts, but to get to thinking about what I needed in that moment, which was that I felt like a layer of dust had fallen over me and that I needed to renew my sense of contact with the world. Mm-hmm. But also I think that I needed to challenge some of my very long-standing approaches to the world, which, you know, were uncomfortable with expressing something as soft as that and as uncynical as that, you know. And it was a moment for me of shedding a bit of the teenage me, really, and you know, realizing that she'd been wrong about a lot of things. So yeah, it felt quite revolutionary for me to write it, definitely.
Well, that's beautiful. It also, in some ways, parallels my process in the beginning of the pandemic, which is I kept asking myself, what's still true? Mm. You know, on a certain level of expectation, you know, I expected to be in New York City or traveling. Instead, I was in Barre, Massachusetts, you know, where I have a home, and I was living in the country. I came up here from New York thinking I'd be here for 2 weeks. And it was 8 months before I got back to New York for the first time. And everything was different. And the retreat center that I had co-founded, that was such a deep part of my own heart, had to close. Who knew if we'd ever be
that
able to?
That must have been a huge loss.
It was
There's a
huge loss
of kind of rhythm in that, isn't there? Yeah.
And we started it in 1976. And all I kept thinking is, I want to make it to 50 years. Why can't we make it to 50 years? And now I look at that and I think, it's all right. Whatever happens, you know, happens. But yeah. I was just on fire. Like, we have to make it to 50 years. And so we went online. We began teaching online, which had never been a strong component, really, before. And it was reinventing ourselves. And then the staff who were still here and, you know, who needed work. And I mean, it was such a complex system. And I kept thinking, what's still true? Like, what can you rely on, you know, as a kind of North Star, as something to help you make choices or guide your actions or decide what's right for today, whatever it might be. And it's a very powerful process just to ask that, like, what you did it when you said what's deeper, you know?
Yeah.
What's even deeper than this presentation to the world that I did?
I'm just kind of processing what that must have been like for you, really, because it's that huge change that comes to you totally without without any choice involved. Mm-hmm. But that sense of reorientation that I always find so interesting in people, that we are capable of feeling absolute despair and rolling from that into a completely new vision of how life's going to be. And it's almost seamless. Yeah. And that's obviously what you had to do. That's not to negate the suffering that was involved, but you obviously found this completely new way to do it.
Yeah, it's like really amazed, you know, at the human capacity. And it comes down, I think, in some ways, again, to awareness or attention or mindfulness, that we can look again. We can be more fully present. We can look at our assumptions and think, well, maybe it's not going to be the old way. Maybe it's going to be a new way. And that which may also be the engine of our ability to find awe.
Yeah. I mean, I find awe in that. I mean, you know, I get lots and lots of letters from people about just these kind of situations, because that's what they read into wintering. That's why they've responded to wintering. And I find it really does trigger my sense of awe to hear how people scramble. But it seems to me that a key part of that process is getting to an acceptance of what is, you know, what is right now, what situation am I actually in, as opposed to the situation I think I should be in or I want to be in. And that's almost the work of a moment. It can take a long time to get there, but when it comes, when you truly absorb, like, oh, this is how it's happening now. This is this is not in my control and this is what I'm being presented with. People have got this incredible capacity to then just completely switch realities almost into the current one. I love that.
Yeah, no, it's absolutely beautiful, and you're describing it beautifully. I think it's also, it reminds me of something that I found a surprise. You know, it was sort of a lacking in my own understanding, which was that I was so accustomed to thinking of awe, partly because of the research that I was familiar with, having to do with the natural world. You know, like research would be done with people going into, you know, a grand forest somewhere and seeing the immensity of the trees and feeling awe at their lifespan, at their majesty and all of that. And so I assumed it was like really where people were contouring their understanding of awe. And it turned out that both through readings I did and through understanding more about where the research was going, that more people, it seems, feel awe at human endeavor than at, you know, magnificent trees, that somebody made it and they survived, or look at that adversity and look at how they cared about others during it. And that really helped me. It really inspired me. Think, look at that. We can have tremendous awe for one another.
When I began writing the book, I started with those, traditional kind of expressions of awe. You know, I thought about the giant redwood trees and I thought about mountains and things like that. And I think I was rescued from that track of thinking by the pandemic, funnily enough, in that I had this kind of desolate moment of thinking, well, if I'm going to write about awe, then I need to go to a mountain, and I can't go to a mountain because I'm in lockdown. And I felt terribly sorry for myself about that for a couple of weeks. And then this realization kicked in that said, that's such a recent idea of awe that it's part of tourism almost, you know, that it's a thing that you go to visit on holiday and you have a nice time and you see something beautiful and you take a photo and you put it on Instagram and everyone admires you for going there somehow. I'm not sure how that works, but that seems to be what happens. And there you go, you've arranged your awe. And of course, most people can't do that. And I suddenly got filled with this sort of political kind of uprising of like, right, well, then it's my responsibility to talk about awe in a completely different way and to figure out how everybody can find it, how people that are confined to their houses can find it, people who are sick, people who are caring for someone, people who don't have enough money to travel to these remarkable locations. And that really totally changed the course of the book. And there was, funnily enough, a chapter that I ended up cutting because I couldn't make it fit, about experiencing awe at a protest march and the awe that came from being amongst this mass of people who were all pointed in the same direction and feel, and you know, you could feel the deep passion in the room when you were amongst them. That was kind of a touchstone for me, really, about thinking about how awe is not just about prettiness, you know, it's not just about something nice to see, and it's not something we can necessarily take a photograph of.
And going back to your comments about acceptance, has me think of the this quotation from the late theologian Howard Thurman, who talked about looking at the world with quiet eyes as a way of encountering the world in a new way, and how it sounds perhaps passive or quietistic, but it's really not. It's that acceptance is kind of the essential foundation for movement, for action. Otherwise, we're just kind of in battle with what is, rather than starting from a very different place.
I really have gone deep into the kind of practice of acknowledging what I don't know lately and what I don't know how to solve. Because actually, I almost think some of the trouble we're in is caused by people wanting to rush forward with a solution before they've really engaged with the fullness of the problem. Mm-hmm. And I mean, you know, that's a difficult place to be in. I was watching a documentary by a UK environmental presenter, TV presenter called Chris Packham this week, and he's just made a program basically asking, well, what do we do next? Do we start, you know, is it time for mass civil disobedience? Will that even work? And what I admired in it, and it was something that I'd not really seen hitting the mainstream too much before, was his just ability to reside in his own doubt and his complete uncertainty, and to really explore the lack of clarity about what will do something, you know, or what will make others take action, what will convince people of the urgent danger that we're in. And that, it's, as you say, that could seem to be really passive. It could seem to be a really useless approach, but actually I think we need to go through that stage. It's a crucial stage to go through before we know, begin to understand what to do. It's an exploration phase, because what we know is that what used to work doesn't work anymore in terms of the way we speak to each other, in terms of the way we take action. We need new ways. And yeah, that state of watching and listening, it's such a soft thing to do. And I think that softness is so important for us to find at this particular phase in our history.
You know, you tell a story in the book about first learning meditation, and that it's actually about learning to take off your shoes. I'm wondering if you could share that story.
Yeah, so I learned meditation. I'd wanted to do it for a long time, but I was propelled into it by a huge personal crisis, and I was incredibly anxious and so deeply unsettled that I think it allowed me to make this huge change. And the teacher that I worked with, he was very firm that you had to just do the thing, you know. Like, and I try to explain this to other people now, and I really admire the way he got it across to me, because it is hard to convince people of this, that you actually have to go into meditation expecting very little from it, you know. Uh-huh. If you're going in seeking a psychedelic experience with a full light show, you know, like some sort of direct revelation. that's it's just not going to work. But I kept coming back to him and saying, I feel really weird. And he was like, great, go and meditate, you know. and I think, you know, that time was a real period of learning for me about all I had to do was take off my shoes and make contact with the ground. That was what I was craving. That was what I needed to do in order to get there. But also that could just be the end result in itself. Like, I didn't have to be looking for anything bigger than that. It was actually this very beautiful, small moment of connection that was actually the thing that I needed to heal me. And it really, really did. But it was that very humble commitment to going back and sitting in meditation and letting that be the end in itself. Yeah, and not being like the special chosen one that gets the special experience, you know.
That's great.
I'm sure you've battled this personally many times with lots and lots of students over the years.
And in myself, you know, because what's coming up in my mind is beautiful. And you know, sometimes I think, looking back at my life, that I'm learning the same lesson over and over again, but hopefully at a deeper level each time, because
we hope.
In 1971, this teacher said this to me, and 1974, this other teacher said kind of a similar thing to me, and each time it was this great opening. And in 1984, I'd already been practicing meditation for like almost 14 years. And we brought this Burmese teacher, Saira Upandita, from Burma, which was very hard to do in those days and probably again. And he taught a three-month retreat that I sat under his guidance, never having met him before. And we were meeting him 6 days a week for these short meetings just to describe our practice. And we were told to be able to describe one sitting and one walking period of meditation to him. And so most of us took notes. But before I could read any of my notes, he would look at me and say something like, for a long, long period, he would look at me and say, "Tell me everything you noticed when you took off your shoes," which was nothing. So I'd leave. That was the end of the meeting. And I'd sit and walk as mindfully as I could and take off my shoes as mindfully as I could. And then I'd come in the next day and he'd say, "Tell me everything you noticed when you drank a cup of tea," which was nothing. So I'd leave and I, you know, take off my shoes as mindfully as I could in case he went back to that and, you know, drink the cup of tea as mindfully as I could, feeling the warmth of the teacup and smelling the tea and tasting the tea. And I'd come in the next day and he'd say, "Tell me everything you noticed when you washed your face," which was nothing. So I quickly saw where things were going. And I called it in my mind the torment of continuity. But of course, in reality, it was fabulous because everything mattered as much as everything else.
Yeah. That's just such a wonderful way of instilling that in your mind. I love that. But I also think about how I worry that we're learning to perform that contact rather than to actually have it.
Yeah.
You know, like as you were saying about, you know, what did you notice about drinking your cup of tea? I think about all of those images I've seen on Instagram of a woman. I call her Yoga Girl. She's like the kind of perfect white skinny woman in her like perfect yoga gear. And, you know, she's either sitting in a perfect lotus or she's, you know, she's really cherishing her cup of tea, like really properly cherishing it, you know. And I think we get handed this vision of what perfect practice looks like. And we believe in it, and we believe in it a little too much, because actually the truth of living, of being in that constant, you know, mindful, that pursuit of mindfulness, that kind of way of life, is that it looks really disorderly from the outside, and it feels quite disorderly. And it's not full of these moments of Instagrammable bliss, you know. it's actually a little more patchy than that for most of us. And I'm always seeking to convey that as my experience, you know, that, oh God, I just burnt myself on the cup of tea instead. How do they hold those hot cups of tea in two hands? I don't think they're drinking very good tea, honestly.
Well, that's why the subtitle of your book in either country is so great, because what's the reality? You know, we're anxious or we're exhausted or we're upset or we're afraid, or, you know, that is the reality. And so it can't all be sweetness and light, you know, and still be real.
No. And the last thing we should all start doing is trying to make it look more like we're experiencing that. Like that's the opposite of a useful approach to this. It's much better to wade into the suffering and the chaos, I think, and to just be there. Like that's one of the greatest things you can learn to do sometimes.
The other side, though, I will say, which also just occurred to me, is that sometimes we just need a break, you know, we need respite and the delight of a nice cup of tea.
Yes, just have your cup of tea, you know.
yeah, and we're kind of fortified to look at the anxiety and deal with the suffering, which is so immense sometimes.
It's really hard to get the balance right when talking about these things, I find, because
sometimes
we just need to escape ourselves, you know. Like there's a period of time when it's good to sit with these things, but we also need to learn when to just move on to do something else for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, that's the kind of fine balance of life skill that we find it very hard to communicate these days. You know, it's not an absolute, like, sometimes be with the trouble, sometimes watch an episode of Friends and just forget about your existence for a little while, mm-hmm. and you'll feel mm-hmm. better after it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I really, drawn to that, you know, in so many ways that in funny way, like, and now I'm moving closer to the word balance and an appreciation of it. I used to think of balance as mediocrity. I thought, well, that's boring, you know.
Yeah.
But it's something so different than that. You know, if you feel like so many beautiful things can emerge if our being were only more in balance, you know, if our pace was only a little more balanced, or we had options, we thought, you know what, I can't right now. I need to drink this cup of tea, or I need to watch an episode of Friends, or whatever it might be.
Yeah. Yeah, I've written a little bit about balance in the last couple of years as well, in terms of what balance might actually look like is doing both extremes rather than living in this perfect kind of midway path, you know, that that I find that I quite often need to do both, and that my behavior across a year balances. But yeah, within the moment, we might be living in one extreme or another, but across a longer period of time, that looks like balance. And I often think about that as the idea that, you know, when water's boiling, if you measure different points of it, it will be all sorts of different temperatures. But overall, we get this sense of balance. And I think it's another way of saying you don't have to get it perfectly right all the time. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's about exploring the edges of things and then coming back to the middle.
Yeah, beautiful. And I'm also thinking of some years ago, my pre-pandemic book, in terms of writing it, but it was released right in the heart of it, was called Real Change. Yeah. It's about the ways that interchange and transformation can empower us as change makers in the world. And in that book, one of the things I wrote about is the necessity of joy and goodness for activists. You know, it's that side of things for that balance. Because here are people who are right on the front lines of suffering, either in their personal lives, in their family or community or their livelihood, and working so hard to right the world's injustices, to do what we can, and how it can be so important and so difficult to have moments to just enjoy something. It really is. And all the people I talked to, you know, for that book, I think every single one of them struggled with that thing that just to, it came out with predominantly with this one friend who the guilt he felt just to enjoy a banana, you know, it was pretty immense, you know?
Yeah.
So I'm curious about your own impressions of this and the blocks we may have to experience enchantment.
Yeah, well, actually, I've had some, you know, some people say very directly to me, well, how can I let myself do that? You know, how can I allow myself to have pleasure almost when the world's on fire?
Yeah.
And I think my honest answer to that is, I mean, it's twofold, because, you know, on a very basic level, there's a long fight ahead of us, and we need to be able to restore ourselves and to take enormous care of ourselves to sustain long-term activism and long-term change, rather than to burn out very quickly, which is what we'll do if we don't have these moments of not just rest, but joy. Mm-hmm. But I also think in a more political way, you know, the bad guys make being bad look fun. You know? Mm-hmm. Like the people who are behaving the most destructively make it look great fun. And that's their argument, that, you know, we cannot let these puritanical people take away our pleasure and our joy. Mm-hmm. And I think we have a responsibility to show our joy too, to really manifest it, to really show what we're fighting for, what the good I'm going to even say fun. I don't like the word fun. I'm even going to say fun. Like, where's the pleasure? Where's the fun? Where's the joy? Where's the happiness in what we're arguing for, in this better world that we're arguing for, where people are kinder and more considerate to each other, where they take better care of their planet, where they, you know, with all their being, resist violence. We need to not just make it look joyful in a false way, but we need to show what a joyful thing that is. And so we should lean into that. You know, we should be taking those moments of pleasure, because that's ultimately what this is about. This is what this battle is for, that seems to be raging across the world at the moment. It's a set of values and yeah, but it certainly comes up a lot for me.
Well, a life of attention and curiosity and connection and contact and awe. It sounds like a lot of fun. You know?
Well, we know that, Sherry.
All right. Balance. I should bring in balance, because certainly, you know, that clarity is so important, not to be overriding or overlooking the very real distress and pain and difficulty that there is, and somehow being able to hold both the joy and the possibility and the movement and the very real pain that a lot of people go through in life and systems support in some cases. And to hold them both implies the kind of openness and expansiveness and freedom in our own minds, which is kind of the greatest joy.
Yeah. Yeah. And unfortunately, I think maybe that joy doesn't transmit very well as a TV show. You know, it's quiet. It's, you know, it's maybe like it doesn't show extreme emotions or whatever. Yeah. It's a much nicer way to live. And that's because it has the capacity to integrate pain into its worldview and integrate suffering and to acknowledge people's struggles, rather than to reject anyone who's struggling or to deny that it's happening or to kind of constantly push it back. And to me, that just feels so urgent to express. And so, yeah, that takes me back to choosing a word like enchantment. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's great. The natural world is such a big part of this book and your life. And one of the things that strikes me about the natural world and that reflection is how it relates to interconnection in the Buddhist framework, that however alone or separate we might feel, we're actually part of a vast network of life. And what happens over here is not separate from over there. And I'd love to hear your thoughts about interconnection and this more vivid connection to nature.
Yeah, I mean, I think you've put it really well, actually. I think that when we talk about interconnection, we often assume that that's a human interconnection, and that derives directly from being in the company of other people. But I experience it really differently to that. I feel like the interconnection is bigger. It's planetary. It's with landscape. It's with animals, with plants. You know, it's about feeling the sentience of the entire system and the way that we are not the master of it, but that we're absorbed into it, that we're part of it, that we're part of this huge being. That's how that expresses for me, really. But also for me, and, you know, I always write from my perspective as an autistic person. I need time in solitude and in reflection to really feel that human connection. Like, social relationships take a long time to process for me, and I need my time. I need my time walking. I need my time swimming. I need my time sitting in the woods, to really process what I've learned from people in my last bout of contact with them. And it's often at those moments when I actually feel closest to them, when I feel like I'm truly able to engage with their needs and what they're telling me and you know, how that relationship's expressing itself. And so, yeah, I think there's a sort of mode of thought that says that taking time to yourself, going into contemplation, is selfish and it's isolative. But my experience of it is the opposite. I feel like I come back as a better friend, a better family member, a better parent when I've had that engagement with people that comes from quiet, from silence.
Well, this has been such a wonderful conversation. I don't want it to stop, but we're nearing the end. I'm already thinking about, I can have you back when we talk about creativity. Oh boy, it's great.
Oh yeah, please do. Have me back. It's been so nice to talk to you.
I'm wondering if, as we close the conversation, you could give us a reading from the book.
Oh, I'd love to. So this is a little bit in the section on fire. In summer months, I'm in the business of catching moths. Where there is a lit bulb and an open window, I'm there too, cupping my hands around a fluttering form that's determined to hurl itself against the light. Both my husband and Bert are afraid of them. They're too quick, too intent. I don't think they mean to menace us. It's just that we're invisible to them, a thing of such scale that we're beyond perception. I will not have them battered at with a newspaper, so I clamber over the kitchen table and balance on the backs of chairs to reach them before setting them loose into the night. It's a thankless task, because soon they're back again, bumping against the glass. It must be such a bafflement to them, this invisible barrier between desire and possibility. We are more moth than we know. Small, frustrated, capable of only tickling a world that we wish would feel our heft. We share that attraction towards the brightest object in our field of view, an equal fascination with candles and conflagrations. We sense the danger, but we can't look away. In fact, we're drawn to circle it endlessly, getting closer and closer until it consumes us. Even when we think the sky might be falling, we stay to watch. It's elemental to us, this alertness, this panicked, flitting attention. Fire is the shadow side of enchantment, the dark, gleaming sorcery from which we can't tear our gaze. It shows us the wild danger that still resides in nature, the power it retains to devour and destroy. It is impolite, contagious, capable of catching from house to house while we stand helpless. It licks our palms like a moth in cupped hands. We have not understood this earth's full potency until we have recognized fire. I'm now trying to close the book so quietly that you can't hear it, but I'm failing.
Very, very beautiful. Thank you. You're an inspiring writer, really. It's beautiful.
The feeling is really mutual. Sorry, it's just been lovely to talk to you again.
Well, it's lovely speaking to you again. Now I want to go to England. I haven't gone anywhere in years.
come.
Thank you. And for everybody listening, I really recommend getting a copy of Catherine's new book, Enchantment, Awakening Wonder in an Anxious Age, which is available in hardcover, ebook, and audiobook formats wherever books are sold. Thank you so much.
Hey, folks. Thanks for listening. If you'd like to learn more about Catherine's work, to get a copy of Enchantment, or any of her other books, you can visit her website, catherine-may.co.uk. And for more on Sharon's teachings, her many online offerings, or to pre-order a copy of her new book, Finding Your Way, you can visit sharonsalzberg.com. This has been the Meta Hour podcast from the Be Here Now Network. May you be safe, may you be happy, may you be healthy, and may you live with ease.